Significant progress was made in two major investigations. First, in the search for the person who leaked the Pentagon documents.
The person who leaked U.S. classified documents, prompting a national security investigation, is a gun enthusiast in his 20s who worked on a military base.
And second, for the people responsible for beheading a Ukrainian soldier and videotaping it.
Ukrainian intelligence might already have certain clues on who might be responsible for this war crime and for the beheading of Ukrainian prisoner of war.
And later in the program, the Ukrainian energy industry is once again exporting electricity to its neighbors. We'll find out how they did it. Today is Thursday, April 13th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. President Joe Biden has weighed in on the leaked documents controversy. The AP's Sagar Meghani has the story.
President Biden says he's concerned about the leak of sensitive government documents to a degree. While visiting Ireland, the president said he does not like that the Pentagon documents leaked in the first place, but
there's nothing contemporaneous that I'm aware of that is all pretty controversial.
It's the first time he's spoken publicly about the documents that were posted on social media sites, apparently detailing U.S. and NATO aid to Ukraine and American intelligence assessments of allies. There are no clear answers as to how many were leaked or by whom.
There's a full-blown investigation going on, as you know, with the intelligence community and the Justice Department, and they're getting close. I don't have an answer.
Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Continuing the story now, progress has been made in identifying the source of those leaked Pentagon documents. Reuters' Edward Baran reports.
The person who leaked U.S. classified documents, prompting a national security investigation, is a gun enthusiast in his 20s who worked on a military base. That's according to a Washington Post report on Wednesday, citing fellow members of an online chat group. The person shared classified information to a group on the instant messaging platform Discord of about 24 men and young boys who shared a, quote, mutual love of guns, the Post said. The Post based its report, which did not name the person, on interviews with two members of the Discord chat group. Reuters was unable to verify details of the report. Discord said in a statement earlier on Wednesday that it was cooperating with law enforcement. The Department of Defense and the Department of Justice did not immediately respond to a Reuters request for comment. The Department of Justice opened a formal criminal probe last week after the matter was referred by the Pentagon, which is assessing the damage done by what may be the most damaging release of classified U.S. information in years. The leak purportedly reveals details of Ukrainian military vulnerabilities and information about allies, including Israel, South Korea, and Turkey.
Reuters' Edward Baran reporting. On Thursday afternoon, The Washington Post identified the suspect as a 21-year-old IT specialist with the Massachusetts Air National Guard. According to the Post, he has not yet been charged or arrested, and the investigation continues. VOA cannot independently verify the information in the Washington Post's article. How has the war changed the relationship between Ukraine and the rest of Europe, and how will that relationship evolve when the war ends? I speak with William Courtney. He's an adjunct senior fellow at the nonpartisan nonprofit RAND Corporation. He previously served as the U.S. ambassador to Kazakhstan and Georgia. He's written a new article about the surprising evolution of Ukraine's turn towards Europe.
The fact that Europe is so accepting now. Accepting, you know, as you know, in June, the EU announced candidacy was accepted, and Ukraine's been waiting for this for a long time. But I think the degree to which Europe has welcomed Ukraine has been a pleasant surprise. For so long, while Ukraine has had really 30 years of democratic development, some of it checkered, if you will, particularly in the area of corruption. But the idea that Ukraine might be ready for European Union membership is generally accepted that that's not yet ready. But what we have seen now in the war is Ukraine accelerate reforms. So the surprise has been how quickly the EU has accepted Ukraine and so many refugees. And the second surprise is how much progress Ukraine seems to be making to prepare itself to go into the EU.
Now, you mentioned in your article the aid that European countries are giving to Ukraine, taking in refugees, military aid, humanitarian aid, things like that. Do you see Europe helping Ukraine in similar ways after the war with rebuilding?
So the EU and Europe in general, because Great Britain, of course, is not part of the EU anymore. So Europe has stepped forward to take the lead. So the G7 has created a coordination mechanism, which is welcome. But Europeans are recognizing that they will be in the lead. And that makes a lot of sense if Ukraine is going to go into the European Union for Europe to take a leading role in reconstruction. So I think the fact that the United States and Europe are going to be major donors. And then there is the question of the extent to which some allegedly $300 billion in Russian central bank assets, which are in Western banks, central banks mostly, the extent to which that would be used for financing will be important. But the Europeans see that they will have the principal responsibility for guiding reconstruction.
Is all this altruistic? Are the Europeans looking to get any kind of leverage over Ukraine, do you think?
They probably, Europeans sense a responsibility to help lift up Ukraine, to bring it in to Europe. And there's a strong moral element to that. But also, Ukraine's entry will help strengthen the European Union in important ways. So just as it was important for Western Europe when the Berlin Wall fell to bring the Central and East European countries into the EU and into NATO to help stabilize them and reduce the risk of instability in the future, that same logic exists now for Ukraine to help stabilize Ukraine and reduce the risk of instability, which could have adverse impacts in Europe.
William Courtney is an adjunct senior fellow at the nonprofit Nonpartisan RAND Corporation and former U.S. ambassador to Kazakhstan and Georgia. Ambassador Courtney, thanks so much for your time today. Thanks for your analysis.
You're quite welcome.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. There's an update from Ukrainian intelligence officials on the search for the culprits shown in the video of a soldier being beheaded. And President Volodymyr Zelensky marks a special anniversary. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv brings us up to date.
Today, Dmytro Lubinets, chairperson of the Parliamentary Committee on Human Rights, he went live on the national TV and he mentioned that actually Ukrainian intelligence might already have certain clues on who might be responsible for this war crime and for the beheading of Ukrainian prisoner of war, and even might have some clues on when and where this was happening, because for the moment we don't have any confirmations of the location and timing of this particular case happening. In terms of the identity of the soldier, there is no particular details on that. And in general, Dmytro Lubinets did not really provide any details or any deep details on this case. He just mentioned that intelligence is actually on that. And it might be that they already have a certain idea and certain picture of what happened.
So he mentioned that the intelligence services have clues, but he didn't mention what those clues are.
Yeah, exactly. So for the moment, it's too early to say. And yesterday, the Ministry of Defense of Ukraine was out also with a statement asking media and society and social media users not to share this video further, because people already started to, you know, trying to identify this person. And in order to show respect for his family, the Minister of Defense is asking not to continue with sharing this content.
And today also marks an anniversary of sorts in Ukraine, and President Zelensky addressed the country talking about it. Can you tell us what he said? What happened?
Yes, actually, today is a year since Ukrainian missile called Neptune destroyed Russian flagman ship Moskva. This was a huge case, and this was a very I should say that it probably was one of the biggest military success of Ukrainian soldiers, Ukrainian armed forces, since the beginning of this full-scale invasion. At least it was definitely one of the biggest in the Black Sea. And today, President Zelensky went out with a statement reminding society, first of all, about this huge success of the Ukrainian armed forces. And basically, it was a certain, you know, statement just to make this, to create this additional positive vibes for the society. President Zelensky was reminding them about such, you know, positive also cases that have been already happening, just, you know, to make people feel a little bit more optimistic about upcoming actions, which everyone, of course, are talking about.
And did he give any information on those upcoming actions? Do we know when or if a spring offensive might happen?
For the moment, not particularly. So there are no details, neither from President Zelensky or any other Ukrainian top officials and top military officials. But what we definitely hear from Ukrainian military authorities and President Zelensky himself, that people are encouraged not to talk, you know, too much about it, and not to expect it to happen soon. So basically, what it's meant that Ukrainian armed forces needs time to get ready. So it might take longer than it was expected, but it looks like that Ukrainian armed forces are just, you know, getting ready and do not want to rush the beginning of this actions too much.
Well, we'll certainly stay tuned for more details. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. As always, Anna, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
Ukraine's energy minister this week said the country has resumed its electricity exports to European countries. It's a dramatic turnaround from just 6 months ago, when Russian bombardment of power stations plunged much of the country into darkness. My colleague Lori London spoke with Olena Pavlenko. She's an energy expert with the Kyiv-based think tank, the Dixie Group, about how Ukraine has been so successful in recovering from attacks on energy infrastructure.
Even before the war, Ukraine was synchronized with its electricity system with Russia and Belarus, and it exchanged electricity with these two countries. Ukraine expressed its will to join the electricity system of the European Union maybe 5 or even more years ago, and it took quite a long time to prepare for this synchronization. When the war started, all these processes became much more faster, and the European Union immediately agreed that Ukraine should be synchronized with its own electricity system as soon as possible. So a few hours before the war started, Ukrainian electricity system was disconnected totally from Russia and Belarusian system and started to work in a so-called isolated mode. So we could not work neither with Belarus and Russia nor with the European Union electricity system. For 3 weeks of the war, Ukrainian electricity system worked in such isolated isolated mode and proved that it is stable enough and resilient enough to be synchronized with the European one. So in March, we were synchronized with European Union electricity system and started to support each other with electricity exchange. In June, we started to sell electricity commercially. So we started to earn on this trade with the European countries.
How has Ukraine been so successful in its ability to recover from the attacks on the energy infrastructure that have come from Russia?
Actually, in October last year, when Russia started specifically destroy our generation and also networks in electricity sector, we could not sell the electricity to the EU. We stopped this electricity export and started to supply electricity only for Ukrainian citizens and for business to survive. How Ukraine survived with this total destruction of the infrastructure? One, there was an incredible work on the ground. When we talked to local communities, they said that local energy companies worked day and night to be able to restore the electricity supply within hours or within a day. But also, there was a huge supply of different equipment from Western partners. The US also supplied a lot of critical infrastructure and equipment for the energy system. And it immediately went to the energy companies close to the front line to be able to replace those damaged infrastructure which we had on everyday basis. Also, we did have quite a stable nuclear power generation, and it helped us to keep basic electricity supply for Ukrainian citizens. Russia destroyed a lot of coal-fired generation, while nuclear power plants, they remained stable. Of course, we still have Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plants, the biggest nuclear power plant in Europe, which is occupied now. And it is really a huge threat for Ukraine and for Europe if something happens there. But in general, nuclear sector helped a lot to Ukraine to survive during this winter.
Ukraine just started trading electricity again with European countries. How important is it for Ukraine's economic recovery?
Ukraine bears huge losses because of the war. In all sectors, we do not have a possibility to raise prices and to have market prices on gas and electricity for our households, consumers. So we have a huge gaps. It's much better if the country can earn money in order to recover from such huge damages. And the trade of the electricity with the European Union is one of the possibilities. For the future, Ukraine will be able not only to get something from European Union, but also support European Union with energy supply. Financially, it will help Ukraine to organize a recovery process faster and more efficient.
VOA's Laurie London speaking with Olena Pavlenko, an energy expert with the Kyiv-based think tank, the Dixie Group. We know the big picture. Russia and Ukraine are fighting for land inside Ukraine. But in the most beleaguered places of conflict going back to 2014, what exactly is left to fight for? In part one of this three-part series, Heather Murdoch reports from Sversk, where the city's cemetery is on the front lines.
Buried in this grave is Sergei Kotako. His neighbors say he was a good man, a retired electrician who helped care for elderly women in his building. During 2 months of heavy battle here last summer, cluster bombs fell, and on one occasion, he didn't make it to the shelter on time. Locals say, nowadays, everyone in town knows each other, and they all knew Kotako. Here's Angelina, a resident of Sversk.
The war somehow brought us together. There's not many of us left here. Before, there was 11 or 12,000 people here. Now, it's only around 2,000. When the humanitarian aid comes, we all go to the same place to collect it.
This town has been a war zone since 2014, and much of the population fled after Russia invaded last year. The people remaining survive on food and water brought in by aid groups. Kotako is one of many in this town who are buried in makeshift graveyards, gardens, and fields. The town cemetery is on the front line, only a few kilometers away. In town, tanks and artillery are hidden behind apartment buildings, but we are told not to take pictures, in case it gives away their positions. The sound of shelling, both outgoing and incoming, is continuous. This is Galina, a Seversk resident.
Why do we deserve this? It's the only question I have. It's the same question I keep asking. Why are they torturing ordinary people?
Wartime has galvanized patriots across Ukraine. Many support the idea of fighting until total victory or total defeat. But this far east, among the pockets of people remaining, it is not unusual to find locals who identify with Russia. Most people we meet won't declare support for either side publicly. They don't know who will rule the area in the months and years to come. Galina, however, says openly she doesn't care who wins if they stop firing. I only want peace, she says. Only calmness. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Seversk, Ukraine.
Hundreds of thousands of Russians opposed to Putin's war in Ukraine have left to find refuge in Baltic countries, where they've joined Belarusians who fled Lukashenko's repression. Ricardo Marquinha has more from the Lithuanian capital, Vilnius, in this report narrated for us by Marcus Harton.
Noise MC is one of the most popular contemporary Russian musicians who has taken a stand against his country's aggression against Ukraine. His music, always critical of the Kremlin, has led him to escape repression. And his refuge has been Lithuania, where he fled with his family. For them, going home does not seem like an option in the near future, not without a radical change in the system.
The end of Putinism. Maybe not Putin itself, because Putinism might continue even after his death. All those people who are around him at the moment, none of them are good to me. So changing Putin to Prigozhin won't work.
Those who have fled Putin's Russia have joined the Belarusian diaspora in Lithuania, people who escaped the repression of the leader Alexander Lukashenko after the 2020 protests in that country. The Belarusian opposition says Lukashenko's forces have put more than 1,400 political prisoners behind bars. Its leader, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, also exiled in Vilnius, tells VOA she fears that Lukashenko will join the war against Ukraine, which she says goes against the wishes of the Belarusian people. She says, our main objective is to prevent the deployment of the Belarusian troops in Ukraine. And you know, our soldiers do not feel like being at war against Ukrainians. We do not regard Ukrainians as our enemies. After the start of the war, Lithuanian authorities banned entry to Russians holding tourist visas for the European Union. Even so, they ensured their doors remained open to all political refugees, Russians and Belarusians. Ingrida Simonyte, Lithuania's prime minister, spoke to VOA.
This is a country that welcomes people in a complicated situation for their moral and political stance. It was like that, it is like that, it will be like that.
Vilnius has become a refuge for thousands of people fleeing from Putin and Lukashenko. The big question for all is, for how long? For Ricardo Marquina in Vilnius, Marcus Harton, VOA News.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.